Charter of the Commonwealth, Section 8 and 11 of the Southern Council, Elizabeth Sharon Fitzgerald, Appalachian.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm Joseph Sanzone, and I represent Cordell Carter, the appellant in this case. Jennifer Johnson, the decedent in this case, was a person who was out of control, and she had many things going on in her life that were so very far beyond what she could manage. The evidence and the argument that I make in this case, I think, needs to be considered in light of the fact that there is some clear testimony about what happened right at the time of the shooting. The children saw my client go into the room. They said that when he came to the house, he did not appear to be angry. He didn't have anything with him. And then an argument happens in the room that doesn't last very long. There's a shot. My client leaves with a rectangular box, which fits the description of his computer, which he says he took away, in which he was angry and threw up against a tree when he got home.
Was it the thought that the video was on the computer? Is that what it was?
I think actually he just wanted it back. And then I think the video probably was on there, and I think that was probably something that was there too. And these videos were such a sensational item in the case. But honestly, Mr. Carter could not be identified as the male on the videos. And there were other people that she had made videos of, and that was clear from the police investigator. And that all just tends to confuse the real issue, which is whether or not the statement that was made to her mother by the decedent the night before should have been admissible into evidence.
Before we get past the gun part, there was a shot. She was found dead with a gunshot wound.
Yes, sir.
And the investigation was conducted, and no weapons were found.
No weapons were found.
So, I mean, the circumstantial conclusion you reached is that it was his, and he took it with him.
That's one. The other one is that Sonny Showalter took it away with him.
All right.
Because, and that was the important part, and of course, his testimony, I'm going to skip ahead to that just as I might. But we called Showalter. I had a hard time getting a summons on Showalter. I went to his house. There was a big dog. The dog wouldn't let me near the door to talk to him. We sent a private...
Stuff they don't teach you in law school.
I'll tell you what. So we sent a private process server out. They served him. And then Showalter doesn't appear in the morning of trial. So I looked back when the case was announced and I saw that he wasn't there. And I said, we weren't ready. We need to find out about him. My pet peeve lately has been the court reporter. We need court reporters in all the courtrooms because we go back into the judge's chambers when this happens. And the Commonwealth knew exactly where he was. They knew that he wasn't in court. They knew that he was over at a relative's house. So I produced my subpoena. We sent the sheriff to get him, and the sheriff brought him back to court while the case was proceeding. So he arrives with a deputy involuntarily, 10:30 the first day of trial. I called him as a witness on the second day. I wanted to put the whole case off until this morning he was there, but when we couldn't, I called him as a witness. I started to ask some questions that I thought would make him an adverse witness for the defense. And after a very few questions, the Commonwealth objected. Mr. Showalter said that he appeared voluntarily, and he said that there was no guns. I think he appeared voluntarily.
But isn't the problem that when you circled back with him later, you waited until after the verdict was rendered to specifically ask for the relief? What do we do with that?
Your Honor, I think that starting from what I had to do, once the judge concluded he was not an adverse witness, I couldn't ask questions of him. I thought if I had been able to press the witness a little more at that point, the witness would be forthcoming, which he was when I was able to offer him as a proffer. The verdict then comes in.
But that issue's not before us.
Yes.
Whether or not the trial court ruled properly or improperly on the adverse witness.
I didn't appeal it. Yes, sir. And I think it's a matter of discretion. The judge heard some answers. He cut me off, and that was it. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't mean to suggest that you do your argument any way than, except the way you want to do it.
Please, yes.
But this issue is the least attractive issue in your case, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me move on. And thank you.
You've got some other issues here, excluding Jennifer's statement, prior acts. You've got some issues that we ought to talk about.
Yes, sir. And I think that both of those issues revolve around an aspect of self-defense that apparently is not well understood. And that is that it's not just what a person reasonably perceives, what the defendant reasonably perceives about another person. The fact of who was the aggressor is important in these cases. It's a central, vital, material piece of evidence in these cases. And that's why we were offering that evidence.
Well, now, when the trial judge said the defendant didn't know about this statement, and as a result, this is a self-defense case, it's not admissible anyway. Did you object on, and can I find it at some place, on the grounds that that's not the only issue in the case? The question is, who is the aggressor, not just the state of mind of the defendant?
Yes, sir, I did say that. And I say that in that argument that occurs when we're addressing that as the first day. When I guess it's on the trial transcript is 140. And I say, the judge says, well, the court had made some suggestions about they had been talking for several pages, beginning, I would say, on page 138, about it never being communicated to Mr. Carter, and that he didn't reasonably fear under the circumstances. And then on page 140, I say that my client does need to put on all evidence concerning who is the aggressor. And that's in the context of that argument that the court is making to me at that time. So I'm addressing with him the fact that it's not what my client thought, but it's who was the aggressor that's important. It's important in terms of the statement. And I don't think it's fair to say that that statement is not a threat, because that's such common language, you're not going to be around very long.
Well, but the trial judge didn't say that.
I don't think you have to. In the brief in opposition. But we would say that it's also tied up, Judge, with the fact of the number of matters of violence that were known concerning Ms. Johnson. Because the proof of her violent and turbulent nature is important, and it can be shown through acts that my client knew of or other acts that demonstrate that she has a predisposition to be the aggressor. That's what they say, I think, in the case that we cite here with respect to that, the Edwards case.
He stabbed her sister's fiancé 10 years earlier.
Yes, sir.
He hit the defendant in 2008 and again in 2009, and he broke her mother's jaw in 2013. Now, those things were actually excluded. There were other things that came in.
Yes, some in and some out.
Right. Now, what you're complaining about the ones that were excluded.
I am. Right. And I'm saying that there's no rational basis for leaving.
What was the trial judge's stated reason for breaking the mother's jaw relatively close to the events here and excluding that?
I don't believe he directly addressed it, because we talked about him in mass, and then he said that he was going to allow the stated offenses and behaviors that he allowed, but I don't think he specifically said why that was excluded.
I thought I read somewhere where the judge said that it was a family issue. This is different because it was a family issue between her and her mother or something like that.
And he seemed to talk about what my client knew, what my client was present to observe. He talked about those things. And getting back to that same sort of line of reason, did my client know it?
That's what I thought you meant, too. He sort of sounded like he felt it was hearsay, that your client had just heard about the breaking of the jaw.
And did he have personal knowledge?
Yeah, that's what it sounded like.
And we think that has nothing to do with law.
Well, don't you need to know, if you're making that call as a trial judge, what are the circumstances of the victim breaking the mom's jaw? And, you know, who started that fight? Or was that self-defense, arguably? Wouldn't you need to know a lot more to make that decision if you're a trial judge?
I would think you would.
But see, I thought, and it's terrible to say because, you know, going into court, we can read a lot of different things and a lot of different cases. I thought there was some evidence that that whole fight came about because she found out the mom was basically having an affair with the defendant here or something like that. And that's when she and her mom had a physical altercation about that.
She suspected that. She believed that. She wanted to move in with my client. My client couldn't, didn't. There was some evidence about a discussion, an argument between the two of them about where my client was going to live, and that's how the mother's jaw got placed.
Yes, I thought it was about the defendant here.
And there was a little bit of that. And if it's agreeable to the court, may I reserve the rest of my time for a vote?
Sure.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. This case presents four issues to the Court. As the Court has noted, there are two evidentiary issues and two post-trial issues. With regard to those evidentiary issues, the Court of Appeals correctly found that the defendant's threat evidence was not admissible when it was proffered, and that the trial court did not err in allowing the defendant to testify to some, but not all, of the victim's prior bad acts. With regard to the post-trial issues, the defendant's own witness changing his testimony was not sufficient to satisfy the jury's verdict for a new trial, and the objection to the Commonwealth's closing argument was untimely, and no motion for mistrial was ever made in this case.
Now, you said at the outset of that statement that some of the things were not offered at the correct time in the proceeding.
Right.
Focus on that for me. What do you mean by that?
Yes, Your Honor. This Court has held in Carey and other cases that the victim's threats made by the victim, the victim's state of mind, do not become relevant or admissible until the defendant has put self-defense at issue, has put on evidence of an overt act that would permit him to act in self-defense. In this case, the defendant's proffered testimony about threats was offered prior to any testimony by the defendant.
Is what we would characterize self-defense, because you look at the reasonable response to a threat, and that's my state of mind. But if it's evidence of prior incidents of being an aggressor, I don't think that's state of mind of the victim. I think that's an event.
Whether the victim was the aggressor, Your Honor, that same evidence doesn't come in until the defendant puts self-defense at issue. Unless the defendant has shown that the victim did something to him, then we look at who was the aggressor. You know, did he start it? Did she start it? But in this case, the Commonwealth's evidence to that point was that the defendant went to her house, shot her while her children was in the next room and left. There was no testimony regarding what happened in that room. There was no testimony before the court or the jury at that time to suggest that the victim had done anything but had been the passive recipient of the defendant's violence.
Did the trial judge at any point imply that, look, you can't raise this later? Or did the trial judge imply, you know, you put on some prima facie self-defense, and of course you can bring it all in if you want?
I think so, Your Honor, and I think the parties were aware of that at the time. This was in the context of a unique situation where there was a victim that was missing. Defense counsel notes on multiple occasions that it may be the court needs to hear other evidence before it can reach this ruling. It notes the Commonwealth is entitled to hold him essentially to the law as to the order these things are presented, but he states as a practical matter, you know, he wants to present his case but the way he wants to present it. So I think there was an understanding even at the trial level that this evidence was not admissible at the time it was proffered. There was an appropriate time for it, and it was later.
And if that was the ruling of the trial court, I would agree with you. But it seems that what the trial court ruled was this evidence, even if she was here, he said, this wouldn't be admissible because the defendant didn't know about it. And so the defense counsel spends about 10 pages trying to make the distinction between presenting this evidence as to who was the aggressor, as opposed to presenting this evidence to show that he had a reasonable fear for his life. And they just keep missing each other. And so having been shut down by a ruling that even if she was here, it wouldn't be admissible because he didn't know about it, is there an obligation on him to raise it again at the end or during his case? or at the end of his case?
Yes, Your Honor, because the court didn't have the opportunity to rule on that evidence at the appropriate time. If we've come back later and we say, now the defendant has put on this evidence, she came at me with a gun, she pointed a gun at me, I think at that point, whether the victim was acting in accordance with her prior threat or whether the victim had threatened him before certainly becomes relevant. And it places that testimony in context the trial court did not have at the time it was asked to rule on it.
But the trial court didn't rule on it necessarily because it was out of place. That he does make that statement, but the basis of the ruling to me seems to be because the defendant doesn't know, it doesn't matter if you bring her in later because it's not coming in.
I agree that there is a flavor for that in the record, Your Honor. However, I think that there was some confusion at that point because the trial court was correctly stating what would be at issue at that point is the defendant's state of mind when he went there, which is all the evidence at that point bore out. And to the extent that the court did rely on an incorrect rationale, I would submit that the court was right for the wrong reason and that the Court of Appeals in that matter should be affirmed.
Now, can you point me to the place in the transcript where I will find that the Commonwealth's attorney raised the issue that it's out of time? I think the reason why the trial judge ruled the way he did was the Commonwealth's attorney didn't even raise that issue.
I'm not sure, Your Honor, although I will note that both parties were arguing both halves of the it can be admissible to show the defendant's reasonable apprehension, or it could be admissible to show what the victim did on a certain occasion. So that issue was certainly before the trial court and wouldn't need any additional fact-finding in that regard.
But isn't the question, I'm sorry to interrupt you while you're looking for the joint appendix, but the question of whether or not who was the initial aggressor or what was the prior evidence of propensity or aggression by the victim, that still ties into an ultimate self-defense theory.
Yes, sir.
Even though, as has correctly been pointed out, you don't have to have subjective knowledge if you're the defendant making that assertion. So, I mean, I'm trying to figure out the logic of this. What relevance would it have at all on either the propensity for aggression based upon prior bad acts or actual, I knew this, and I would tell you I was worried about it, and that's why I pulled the gun out of her hand, pure self-defense. Why would any of that be relevant until there's some self-defense prima facie assertion?
It's not relevant, Your Honor, at that point, and it was not relevant or admissible when it was offered. In this case, pretty much all of this court's jurisprudence that involves self-defense cases, even in addition to Carey and Workman and those type of cases, all the self-defense cases say, when the defendant has adduced evidence of self-defense, at that point, the victim's propensity for violence or turbulence or prior threats made by the victim become relevant and admissible because at that point, we have an actual conflict. We have an actual issue for the jury to decide who was the initial aggressor. At the time when these statements were offered, that simply wasn't at issue in this case.
And I'm really not questioning the relevance. I agree with all of that. I guess I'm questioning the issue of whether it was preserved and whether it had to be raised again in his case in chief to properly preserve it under the theory of he's made the court aware of his position over and over and over again. The court has ruled on a basis that seems to indicate whether you raise this at the end of your case or in your case in chief or after the defendant has testified, it's not going to matter because it's not coming in because he doesn't know. And so my question is, does he have to then object again, put it on the record, and put his proffer in at that time? Is that the law?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe he does have to bring that proffer back before the court because significant things have occurred between when the proffer takes place and when he could have brought it up later.
But why would he have to do that when he's been told without any question, it's not coming in, period? What is he's got a ruling, and it's not a conditional ruling. It's an absolute ruling. He didn't know about it. It's not coming in. So why does he have to raise it again to preserve it?
Because, Your Honor, he was offering it to show what the victim's state of mind was, whether the victim was acting in a certain way. And when that becomes at issue in this case, when he puts on evidence to bring that matter before the trial court, certainly the trial court didn't have any issue in allowing prior bad acts once evidence of self-defense was put on in this case. The trial court was in a different position after it had heard the defendant's own self-defense testimony. The facts had changed by the time the defendant testified.
Let me stop you right there. That may be That may be arguably true about the prior bad act, but it's not with regard to the testimony of the fellow that told him she got a gun. Because the trial judge said he's not going to testify on that subject on any set of circumstances, so the fact that he's not here is done. I don't have to deal with it. But why would he have to raise it again?
Your Honor, I think that he owes it to the trial court to give the court the context in which the court could consider that information properly. The same cases that were cited to the trial court by the Commonwealth, these are all Overt Act cases. People were relying on similar cases as we've relied upon here on appeal. I think the defendant needs to put the trial court in a position to take advantage of that law and to make the right ruling at a time when the evidence would fully support it.
I guess I have trouble with your argument because it appears that defense counsel raised it and said this has to do with who the aggressor is, and the trial judge said, well, it doesn't matter because it's not coming in because he didn't know it. And that is directly contrary to this court's holding in Riddick and several other cases.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would submit that if the court is reading the trial court's decision that way, that the trial court was right for the wrong reason under this court's case in Perry. And the record is fully developed on that point since both parties were arguing who was the primary aggressor issue. And based on those set of circumstances, the court could have found that it wasn't properly before them at that time, as the Court of Appeals did. I would also note, two things. I would say if the court rejects that argument, we have a harmless error argument in this case, and also that threat, or the statement that's been characterized as a threat, certainly didn't rise to the level of threat that we have in Riddick or in Reiner or similar cases where the victim says, actually, I'm going to find that person, I'm going to kill them. Certainly
right,
not.
But then the jury would resolve the ambiguity of that statement as to whether it was a threat or it was something else. I mean, the threshold for relevance is pretty, limited.
Sure, Your Honor. But what we're dealing with when we're talking about a threat is an expression of an intent to harm, obviously, and it only becomes relevant when it can predict or corroborate the victim's future behavior. And so there's nothing in this case about that threat that did predict or corroborate or make it any more or less likely that when the defendant came to the victim, she did not seek him out, that she would have acted in this way. This type of threat doesn't have the kind of design or express intent as other threats that the court has.
But when you associate that with a victim's conduct, it gives a certain tincture to those statements.
I think if you look at the mother's conduct, it gives a tinge toward those statements. This statement that the mother needed to move her stuff and find herself another man because this man wouldn't be around long, in the context of the daughter confronting the mother about sleeping with her boyfriend, could certainly be construed as a statement that the mother needs to find her own man and the daughter is not willing to share her affections with a third party.
But who gets to make that call?
Well, the trial court can make that call as a preliminary matter that this isn't specific enough to rise to the level of design and it wouldn't be relevant to show how the victim acted on a certain occasion. It was too generic of a threat in this case, and the trial court could have made that determination.
In the context of the defendant having a romantic relationship with the victim, the victim's sister, and the victim's mother, you better get yourself a new man because he's not going to be around for a while. Sure sounds like a threat to me.
I would submit that if anything, it was a statement that the mother needed to not continue to have prior relations with her boyfriend and the father of her children. But taking the court's point, even if it was error for the trial court to exclude this threat evidence, and even if it was error for the trial court to limit the number of prior bad acts the defendant was allowed to get into, that error in this case is harmless. The defendant's testimony at trial was incredible. It was contradicted by the physical evidence in this case, and it was contradicted by his own statements made immediately after the shooting. After the shooting in this case, the defendant called his boss, said, give my job to someone else, I've done something bad, you'll see it on the news. He called the mother of the victim and said, come to the house and get the kids, and when the mother protested, he said, Mom, my daughter will be dead by the time you get there, or words to that effect. She's been shot, she'll be dead by the time you get there.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. He shot her. There's any question about that. The question is, was she the aggressor? That's the whole issue in this case.
Your Honor, I think it goes to his credibility because he testified unequivocally that she was still standing and alive and that he didn't think there was anything wrong with her when he left the house. So for him to then go on and make those statements, it shows that his version of events was incredible. Further, there was no gunpowder burns on her hands, which would have been consistent with her holding the weapon when it was fired. She had stippling on her chest that suggested she was shot from a couple of feet away. And the physical evidence as to the bullet's trajectory and how the bullet was fired would have meant that the victim, whose hand was simply knocked up, would have had to flip the gun 180 degrees and have it fall directly level to level of her sternum and fire inverted in a straight line through her lungs, through her aorta, through her backbone, severing her spine, and straight out the window in a perfect straight line trajectory. And the jury was certainly entitled to take this evidence and find, that it was completely incredible, the defendant's version of events in this case, regardless of what threat may or may not have been made upon her in the past, particularly whereas here they did hear evidence of the party's violent relationship. And the Commonwealth would submit that the exclusion of those acts was certainly harmless in this case. And unlike some of the things the court has heard this morning, this is a regular harmless error case. We don't have to rise to the constitutional level of harmless error here. I see that I have a very short amount of time left, but I would briefly note that there was no motion for mistrial made in this case, and the trial court certainly did not err in failing to grant one, and the defendant's objection to the Commonwealth's closing argument, which was made after the jury had retired to deliberate, came too late under this court's case law in Maxwell and Chang and in others. And I'd be happy to answer questions from the court. I see that I'm running down my time here.
All right. Well, you used your time well, I can tell you that. You got to everything of importance.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Your Honor, I anticipated what you were going to ask, or what might come up today when I was arguing on page 141 of the transcript. And I tell Judge Gamble, and this is just basically so that I state my objection completely. I don't mean to argue with the court. And I said then, there are two issues. One is how he knows it and what he apprehends. The other question is there an aggressor and who and what's going on with them? But the question of who is the aggressor and what's been stated deprives them of the opportunity, them being a jury, of understanding more about who was the aggressor that day. So for those reasons and for all the others, Judge, we object to the court's ruling.
But isn't the question of who was the aggressor that day relevant to a self-defense?
It's very relevant, and
all
that's
right.
What I was trying to say.
But at that point in time, there was no self-defense prima facie case made.
We had initially said that we were going to introduce, and I tried to get on because I thought they'd open the door when they asked about the conversation with the mother. I wanted to talk about what was said in the conversation, but I wasn't allowed to because they said it was otherwise inadmissible as hearsay. I was required to put on my evidence. When I started the second day and asked for the continuance, I told him that we were going to put on evidence of self-defense of the judge, and then I set out on page 328 of the transcript of the trial exactly what was going to be said by the mother, that there had been an argument, that she had, the mother was going to have to move her things because this person, but it's more than a person because there's an insult there, and I think that's important for the jury. But
can I focus
right
you on this? What's the best place in the transcript for me to see your argument, which is, I was told that this is over. I can't raise this later, and he's just going to get mad at me if I try to.
128 in the following page through that whole argument that ends with me telling the judge I don't want to argue with the court because I go on, this goes on for...
But 128 was pages. The premature time. The question I'm asking is, what's the best place in the transcript where you, if I'd have been you as a defense attorney, I would have thought to myself, he's telling me I can't raise it later at all. He's not simply telling me what he said a few minutes ago, which is, this is premature. You don't raise this until you do a prima facie self-defense theory.
No, that's where he says I can't raise it at all, that argument. That beginning on page 328 of the transcript, that's my request for continuance, my telling that the mother's not going to be there, the telling about the threats, stating. And we had also stated originally when the mother testified that we were going to put on self-defense. And that was specifically stated by the judge when he said, you can't put it on, you can't ask about this testimony now. You've got to wait until you put on your self-defense evidence. So he was fully cognizant of the fact that a self-defense argument was going to be made when he makes his ruling that I can't ever do it.
And Counsel, you're saying 128. Are you saying meaning
328.
I think you're citing the transcript.
And when that second day comes, we've been told the first day, you can't put it on now. When you put on your evidence of self-defense, I said, well, that's fine. My client's going to testify. That's what we told the judge. That he knew that at that point. But he told me I couldn't do it until I put on my self-defense. Second day, Ms. Moynihan's now in the hospital. And I'm making a motion for continuance so that I can put on all my evidence at one time. And I tell him what the statement's going to be. I'm just setting it out, essentially trying to create a record. And it's in the context of self-defense that we're going to raise. And then the judge starts talking about it in terms of self-defense. And that's what we talk about for probably the next 10 pages. And he understands that what we're talking about is self-defense. He understands that the statement has been made to the mother, not to my client. And he starts talking about it in terms of what was communicated to my client. That was the essential argument all throughout this. What was communicated to my client, not whether or not a person is the aggressor. He kept trying to come back with that.
All right. Thank you very much. Your time has expired. Call the next case.